meeting of the special joint committee on legislative reform will now be called to order. Let the record show that those present are Representative Locker, Co-Chairman Representative Phillips, Senator Fakes, Senator Josephson, and Senator Tim Kelly. You have a packet, and in the packet is our 4-11 rough draft, which has the changes in it that we talked about on Friday and looked at. I've gone through and yellowed some of mine out, so you might want to make sure that everything's included in there. Also in your packet is a letter from Norm Gorsuch, the Attorney General, with his comments on some of our provisions, and we are told that he has looked at Friday's version in making those comments. Also, you have a draft in here on the ethics code. And then we have another letter from Mr. Guanelli on conflict of interest and strengthening the criminal code in some of those areas. What I'd like to do is have, with the committee's permission, is have Dean Guanelli from the Attorney General's office come forward and talk about the letter from the Attorney General. Is that all right with the committee? Dean, please. Recognize the difference between part-time legislators who have to go out and seek gainful employment when the legislature is not in session and full-time state employees?
Sure, sure he does. But I think that the notion is not stopping legislators from going out and getting full-time employment when the legislature is in session, but in prohibiting situations where legislators or anybody can use their dealing with the state, and the key really is dealing with the state. I suppose if you get right down to it, the argument that, well, legislators are only work half time, they only get half the salary that a state employee does, therefore they need to go out and deal with the state, do business with the state, and get state contracts and get state loans and things like that. I think that might even suggest that there is more of an incentive for someone in that situation to use some kind of influence because they need the money. I just don't think that it's appropriate to put all legislators, lump all legislators in the position of saying that they need the money so much that they ought to be given greater opportunities to deal with the state than state employees. I just don't think that's an appropriate way of looking at the problem. I don't think legislators need to deal with the state more than anybody else does.
Senator Josephson. Everybody remain calm.
I'm very calm, but I think that there's a very real difference. If you, as a lawyer working full-time for the state, were to take a civil suit for someone you know and practice before the state court system, I would object to that because you owe full-time loyalty to your public employment. But I certainly don't think that we should exclude attorneys in the legislature. I raise that because in this bill, we have done a lot to limit the influence that an attorney might inadvertently or inadvertently bring to bear in an administrative agency. But I don't think we should sitting legislator from appearing in a state court, because we have another public policy consideration. Unless the administration wants to come down, and I would invite you to do that, and recommend that legislators should get the same pay as some of your full-time public officials, and then we can take a look at that. But we have an obligation to try to make this branch of government attractive to qualified people who the voters can be proud of to come down here and serve, and you don't have that problem.
I agree, and the Attorney General's letter, I think, is careful to state that conflict that constitutes a conflict for one branch of government will almost invariably be a conflict if committed by a person in another branch, and that doesn't mean that in every case is going to be. And I think that in the issue of representing clients, if a legislator is an attorney, I don't think there's any question that during the interim, that legislator ought to be permitted to go ahead and continue gainful employment. I guess the difference of opinion is over the ability of legislators or anybody else to be able to deal with the state on a basis that's somehow different than other state employees.
We have another bill pending which just came out of Senate Judiciary today, which would prohibit any legislator from contracting with the state on any kind of non-competitive basis. I don't know what the legislature will do with that. That's a separate matter. Since the Attorney General raised the issue of state contracts. But
Madam Chair.
Senator Kelly.
Well, Madam Chair, Dean is implying that the only problem that the legislature has with any kind of conflict of interest is that it relates to our relationship to state loans and contracts. It's simply not true. But we're simply a matter of legislators worrying about state loans and contracts. We have no real problem because very few of us have anything to do with state contracts. The loans, for the most part, will pretty much take care of themselves. But what you're advocating here in your letter, dealing with criminal conflict of interest defined, is talking about any potential conflict of interest out there. It's not just limited to state loans and state contracts. It's limited to anything out there that you might be doing in the private world that legislation is going to be acted on, which is virtually everything in this state. You don't limit yourself in your own criminal conflict suggestions. You don't limit yourself to state loans and state contracts. You're talking about business associations, close economic associations, which is defined as being a counsel, advisor, consultative, member, or representative of, or having a financial interest in any association, partnership, business, corporation, or other entity. That pretty much is going to take care of the whole private spectrum in Alaska.
Well, the criminal, I didn't realize we were getting into the criminal conflict of interest provisions, and I won't do so except to note that when you're talking about a criminal conflict of interest, you're talking about someone who makes some kind of actual use of position, an actual effort to use influence, something that is a completed act, something that the law would therefore be able to punish as a crime. And the rest of these conflict of interest provisions, we're talking about appearances, we're talking about being in a position to be able to perhaps use your influence. And you're right, the criminal conflict would cover a wide range of activity. But I think
much wider than just the state loan and the state contract that you just said that you were trying to cover.
Well,
and what we're saying is that it's impossible to get citizen legislators or citizen public officials or citizen assemblymen at the local level if you don't allow them to make a living on the outside. And by necessity, virtually everything you do in this state is going to be acted upon by one time or another, either through the legislature or the assembly.
Well, the criminal provisions which I have set out letter of April 8th do not make any change on current law. The definition of conflict of interest and criminal conflict of interest is exactly the same as it is under current law. The only difference is that the penalties are enhanced depending upon the amount of gain that is obtained or attempted to be obtained by the official. So it makes no change under current law. What we're specifically interested in you're right. The contracts and the loan provisions. And the question is whether there ought to be any different standards for legislators and executive branch officials when they're seeking contracts with the state or seeking loans with the state. And I would suggest that there ought not to be.
I don't think anybody in this panel would disagree with you there. I don't think anybody disagrees. Unfortunately, I think the Attorney General's recommendation contracts in every other sphere outside of just state law enforcement contracts.
I'm new to this committee, but I'm a little puzzled. If we were to make sure that our substantive views were the same as yours, we would have had to wait, in spite of the deadline that the bodies assigned to us, to see what the administration was going to propose. So we went ahead. The fact that we have provisions about loans and contracts does not mean that I'm wrong.
You're wrong.
We asked them.
They're right in substance that they delivered.
Have they got a bill here that I don't know about?
Yeah, we rejected it, but that was 2 weeks ago.
Well, okay.
Well,
as far as I'm concerned, I agree with Senator Kelly. I'm trying to recall exactly what we did, and we'll go through it. But I'm fairly open to the idea that the loans and contract provisions we wrote could apply to the executive branch. I think most of the people in the executive branch are honest people, and I think that those provisions might be adequate. If it's a question of harmony, I'm open to that.
Okay. Well, I mean, we certainly agree that they ought to be the same. And I suppose one reason why we've been hesitating to bring something before this committee that sets out standards for the executive branch is because we, to some extent, disagree with some of the provisions that are in here respecting contracts and loans.
Be specific, Dean.
There's no, for example, on contracts, there's no provision that prohibits a state official from being in a position to use influence when you're talking about a contract that may be given to someone in that person's family. It's as though this legislation is suggesting that it might be okay for there to be influence exerted if someone's spouse gets a loan, if someone's immediate family member gets a loan. The contract provision does not apply to any family members. And when we're talking about the business relationships that are set out here, I would suggest that, and I'm not certain about the percentage that was put in that. Putting that blank on page 3.
We're still hassling over Dean. Dean, this chapter applies to immediate family members. Why would you say the contract section doesn't?
Mr. Berry, can you?
I don't.
Sure, go ahead.
Mr. Berry, can you clarify that? We're on page 3, lines can and tailor contracts. The question I'm going to ask is, a person has a contract, and it says a person to whom this chapter applies may not be a party or have interest in state contracts unless the contract's under competitive bidding. The word person also includes legislative staff and relatives. Is that correct or incorrect?
The immediate family was taken out. Same definition. They want to include spouse, parent, child, grandparent, grandchild, aunt, uncle, or sibling, or being a permanent member of the household. Now, we didn't feel that a legislator should have to worry about his aunt or his uncle's contractual obligations with the state.
Well, you see, that concern might be okay if the result of someone like that seeking a contract is that they subject themselves to an automatic review by this commission, which was one of our proposals. But you've changed the entire structure so that all that is required now is letting people know in the Daily Journal. And so I suppose the question is, if disclosure is the only provision now, then why shouldn't these contracts that are going out to members of the legislative standards, why shouldn't they be at least disclosed? I mean, it's different if you're going to be subject to an automatic review, but you know, I'm talking about disclosure. Every time a change occurs in the entire structure of this bill, some of the previous concerns that this committee had about including or excluding certain people, I think, change. And the structure has gone through a number of different changes. And I think it requires perhaps some reassessment about who is going to be included, who is going to be excluded in some of these provisions.
Senator Joseph.
As I understand it, if you have a conflict of interest, you can resign the position, divest the interest, or make the disclosure. But the disclosure, we specifically discussed this, is not the end of the process. The legislative body and the commission and the attorney general all have certain sanctions that they can invoke. And incidentally, there was a question in, I think, either your letter or the attorney general's as to what the implications were for the criminal law. And we were specifically of the mind that the criminal code was not superseded or repealed. Those penalties still exist. So you cannot. I can assure you that the committee did not intend, and my colleagues will correct me if I'm wrong, as they did minutes ago, we did not intend that disclosure would be the end of the process.
That's correct.
That's fine. But still, my concern is, I mean, are we allowing influence to be wielded when the contract is going to be for somebody else's benefit, a family member?
Okay, let's stick to that subject, if we could. Contracts among family members, if we could stick to that in our discussion, and then we'll go on to the next paragraph. Representative Phil?
I'd like to have it answered, my question that was forwarded at the very first.
What are the very preliminary draft they use membrane the immediate family rather consistently group. There were some real problems that we felt with that. And what has happened is under the contract section on page 3, starting on line 13, a person has an interest in a state contract under this section if the person receives direct or indirect financial benefits. Therefore, a contracting spouse almost certainly you would receive direct or indirect financial benefits. A contract with a parent or grandparent, you might or might not qualify or not.
Okay, the question I have is,
please, Representative Phil.
Okay, the question I have, Billy, is that on line 10, the person, and I think we have a definition for that for people who are covered under that. That includes the legislator, his staff, husband, wife, or spouse, or
no.
Okay, that's what I want to get at.
Perhaps what we need is a definition of direct or indirect financial benefit. I mean, if that's to include something that, you know, income, a source of income from the immediate family, then perhaps that takes care of it.
But how could you, in your draft, suggest that any of us have a relationship with our aunt and uncle, not to mention grandparents, grandchildren? Do you have a relationship with an aunt and uncle? I don't. Does anybody on this committee have a financial relationship with your aunt and uncle?
No, Mr. Chairman.
How can that be considered immediate family?
What?
Just a second, Representative Josephson. Are you finished, Senator Kelly? Senator Josephson?
I will explain my view this way, and this is what was debated. Frankly, there are financial sacrifices that everyone makes when they stand for the legislature. And that's fine, and some of us do it very joyfully because we like the work and we like the opportunity to serve the public. We are willing to have transactions examined to determine if or not we are the beneficiaries, directly or indirectly. But we don't want to subject people who have no other financial involvement with us except consanguinity to penalties themselves. If my 21-year-old son borrows money from the state to open a hot dog stand in the summertime, that's his business. And in fact, he'll be married this summer, so he'll have a family of his own. The fact that he stands as my blood kin should not subject him to all of these administrative processes unless I'm a direct or indirect beneficiary. That's the principle involved. And I think it's a very important principle to me. I must tell you, this has been debated at every legislature and in the Congress as to whether people in the 20th century that have nothing to do with you except that they happen to have sired you or be a grandparent or an aunt ought to be brought into this and penalized in terms of the privacy issues which our Constitution provides for, simply because a nephew or niece has been elected to the legislature. That's what's involved.
Okay, then perhaps the definition of correct or good financial benefit would take care of the problem. As long as the committee faces the issue squarely on, that it's not covering family members, or it's not covering certain family members. That's all that I want to say. I mean, that's my whole point. Is that issue ought to be squarely dealt with. And the same applies to state loans. There is no provision for any kind of family relationship or in fact any kind of direct or indirect financial benefit. That the two provisions are somewhat inconsistent in the way they are treated. So as long as that issue is squarely faced and a decision is made, then the Attorney General will determine whether in coming forward with a bill for the executive branch we want to adopt that same standard or whether we want to come up with something different.
Okay. This on the state loans, you said there was an inconsistency here. Where is there an inconsistency?
Well, first of all, I guess I view contracts and loans as, especially these types of state loans we're dealing with, unless they're housing loans or student loans, is very much business oriented.
Okay, you have no trouble with A, Section A.
I have no trouble with Section A.
On page 3. I'm on page 3,
right.
411 draft. So you have no trouble with A of state loans.
Right.
Okay. B is where you start to have a trouble?
Well, I start to have trouble because, first of all, there's no provision for any kind of relationship with a firm, corporation, or other association, such as there is in a contract or a partnership. It strictly applies to a... It's hard to say who exactly B applies to, but it talks about a legislator being in a position of influence. Subsection A applies to the person who the chapter applies to, and subsection B doesn't say what it means to. But again, the business interests that involve partnerships, corporations, and firms who might be getting state loans, I think causes us some concern.
Is it just state loans you're concerned about now, or any business being regulated by the state?
Well, right now I'm talking about state loans.
Mr. Barrier, you might want to scoot your chair up to the table, sir. Under the state loan section, we don't limit state loans. We don't have the same provisions under state loans as we do under contracts, do we? Yes, sir.
No, you do not. Let me make some general statements. Dean is quite correct. There are definitely differences in the state loans and contracts. First, there is a disclosure requirement in loans. There is no disclosure in the contract section because the contracts are already matters of public record, whereas the loans are not. But secondly, there's a more basic thing. The contract section, in many instances, is flatly prohibitory. It may not. The loan section, and it was very deliberately intended, are, as to the, quote, non-discretionary loans, totally permissive. And as to the other loans, the loans are possible. The commission may look at it, but they're not prohibited. You have a disclosure situation. Loans not a prohibition. And again, that was a deliberate decision of the commission. So they are, they're handled distinctly differently because they're a different nature, a different kind of animal.
Any comments from the committee?
Well, I don't, Madam Chairman,
yes.
I don't see that any great problems have been pointed out. Of course, the administration will have ample opportunities as this legislation lays its way.
Could we talk about the gift section, please? Because that's rather a major part of the letter to us. Dean, could you expand on this? Before we get to gifts, excuse me, the sentence preceding that, for example, contrary to AS 1156-860, the provision on confidential information suggests that such information can be used if it is not used for financial gain. Will you show us where that is in here? We certainly did not mean to be contrary to any Alaska statute.
Page 5, line 4, I suppose, talks about as a conflict of interest. If a person to whom this chapter applies discloses or uses for personal gain or for the person. I suppose the question is whether these kinds of provisions, as we said in the letter, impliedly legitimize that kind of conduct.
Well, that was your second, Bill.
Madam Chairman, one thing I think should be pointed out, this bill does not in any instance supersede the criminal law. What it does is go beyond the criminal law and add another level of conduct, the conflict of interest conduct that would not otherwise be prohibited.
For instance, this particular section is probably redundant.
Madam Chairman, boilerplate. Yes. No, this is not redundant. What this does, it does not take out the criminal sanction.
Right.
It adds the sanction in a particular instance, disclosing confidential information. It seems to be perfectly justified, additional sanction.
Senator Josephson?
Mr. Barrier said it. It's not in derogation of the criminal law. This bill is in derogation of the common civil law that Mr. Condon addressed, but it was not designed to impair rights of prosecution under the criminal code.
Well, this committee has said that on a number of occasions.
Do you have language you want us to put in here?
I could come up with something, hopefully fairly quickly, that would just say something along those lines.
We got a deadline now.
Yeah.
Right.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
I would agree with Senator Josephson that's important, but I think that probably where it comes up, we must state it each and every time, because many people would go just directly to this to quickly solve the problem for themselves, and they should be directed to the state law that is in place.
Okay, so I understand you'll come up with some language before you leave here today for our perusal.
Sure, that'll say something like this doesn't supersede any criminal law, but I think Representative Walker's comment is a good one. Somebody can look at this and say, well, it's okay as long as I don't do it for gain. Similarly, with respect to gifts, it's okay as long as it's under $100. And I suppose we have a real problem with that. Not only does this provision on gifts allow a legislator to accept gifts of $100 or less, but it allows them to solicit gifts of $100 or less, even under circumstances where those gifts are being used to influence that legislator's action. And I think that is...
Sorry, you're too rapid.
Okay, Representative Phillips.
Okay, you know, it seems to me you guys are bringing out all these problems, but not suggesting recommended language in place of... You know what the problem is.
Sure.
We had all these kinds of doodads that come either through the mail or through a messenger or, you know, like a paperweight or a calendar. We had about three or four dozen things a year now. Sending it back would be just a real headache now.
Can you let the record show that I've received one thing all session? Where is this couple of dozen?
Really?
Some of us get these things, but freshmen obviously do not.
That's correct.
Excuse me.
If I could address that comment directly, I stated a couple weeks ago to Senator Kelly that I didn't have any confidence in my ability to draft into this legislation a provision that would cover every situation, that it would make things absolutely clear. But I think that a good opportunity to do just that is in the form of some sort of commentary. Now there is a large commentary to the revised criminal code, and specifically in the commentary relating to receiving unlawful gratuities. Now, receiving unlawful gratuities is if a public servant solicits a benefit of any value or accepts a benefit of $50 or more. Now, what the commentary said was, says, note, and this is the commentary in the Senate Journal from 1978, note that the statute prohibits solicitations of benefits by public servants without regard to the value of the benefit. However, when a public servant accepts the benefit without soliciting it, the benefit must have a value of $50 or more for the crime to have occurred. This limitation is intended to ensure that public servants will not be subject to criminal prosecution for accepting such minor items as a box of candy on Christmas when the public servant did not accept the benefit upon understanding that his action would be influenced. Now, it's that sort of thing. I mean, so you could set a value on it, as it was done in receiving unlawful gratuities, as long as it's not solicited, as long as it's not even accepted under the condition that your vote is going, or your action is going to be influenced.
Can we have that word not solicited in our draft?
So, this provision accepts the $100 precisely cutting.
Wouldn't that be okay, Dean?
We change that to the draft.
Senator Jefferson.
It might be a little clearer, though. The language reads, a person to whom this chapter applies may not solicit a gift, comma, or accept or receive, this is page 5, comma, directly or indirectly, comma, a gift, comma, in excess of $100, etc. It might be clearer to say that a person to whom this chapter applies may not solicit any gift, comma, nor may such person accept or receive, so that the $100 is limited to the acceptance or receipt and not to the solicitation.
I certainly interpreted it to the solicitation.
Okay, what I'm going to do is have Senator Josephson repeat that for the committee and the audience and the record, and have the committee discuss that change. Go ahead. All right.
If you think there's any question on it, on line 5, on line 24, page 5, after gift, may not solicit a gift in any amount or a separate receipt. I think there's an ambiguity.
I need that under
that. All right.
Now, what does this mean? Does this mean that do I have to return a calendar, I guess? Or a date book, I guess?
Do if you ask for it.
I don't ever ask.
You can't go out and ask for it.
Well, I never do.
Let me put it this way. Let me try to be very clear about it. If you accept a gift of any value, there are circumstances where it is intended to influence your action, you accept it under those circumstances, you have not violated this chapter, but you have violated the criminal law.
That's marvelous. So I get a little $10 $10 guest calendar, okay, from ARCO through the mail, which wasn't solicited, and now all of a sudden I am subject to criminal prosecution.
Well, we're not, let's be reasonable about it. We're not talking about that.
Well, it's meant to influence my decision. They have ARCO all over it. They send it to me. They don't send it to every citizen of the state. It must mean it for something.
Well,
and because I don't send it back and make a big deal out of it, right, I'm subject to somebody going to the Attorney General and complaining.
It's meant to influence your decision to buy gas from ARCO. I don't know about going on. Let me read some language here that the Senate in 1978, again in the commentary of the Criminal Code on Bribery, adopted as commentary. Now, the bribery statute talks about just a benefit, accepting a benefit. They're using the broad term benefit. The bribery statutes ensure coverage in all appropriate cases. However, benefits which serve only to provide, quote, a climate for discussion, observant, i.e., picking up a dinner tab or golfing fee, are beyond the scope of the statutes, because the granting of the benefit is not in itself intended or expected to influence an official decision. The giving or receiving of such insignificant benefits when not covered by the code is, however, an appropriate topic to be addressed in conflict of interest statutes and ethical conduct regulations and standards. That was in 1978. The code does not cover benefits that are not intended to influence your decision, but anything else it does cover. So there's a real, I think a lot of people are going to be confused if they take a look at these provisions. They see the $100 limitation on page 5. They see the, what is it now, $100 for meals and social events, and $250 a year on page 6. They're going to be very confused. Well, let's put it this way. They may not be confused. They may go ahead and accept those benefits, and they may be committing a crime.
Well, just, Mr. Chairman, sir, you scare me terribly, and I want you to know that, because you keep resorting back to this is a crime and this is the bribery statute. We're not repealing the statutes on criminal law, and we want the Attorney General to have that residual authority, but I must say it frightens me, not because of the way I conduct myself, but it frightens me as someone who reveres the legislative branch of government to think that when we are working to develop in a good faith mode under a pressure of time, the best possible working draft we can for our colleagues to consider in the whole legislative process, that the mindset in the Department of Law is focusing in on what legislators might be prosecuted for, whether whether it's 36 holes of golf or 18 holes of golf. We want to get you out of this process. And we want to handle our own affairs, except in the cases where there is felonious conduct. And what I see, I have the floor, so I just want to finish this. And I'm saying this with considerable passion, which I feel. When I see the legislation on criminal conflict of interest, and I understand you say that this is already in the law, and I think I respect your judgment on that, but it is so subjective about using official position or office for the primary purpose of obtaining financial gain. 1 hour ago, I was in a committee meeting and we were talking about student loans, and there was a colleague of mine who proposed raising the student loan limit from $6,000 to $8,000. It turned out that we didn't act on that proposal. If I had acted on that, would the Department of Law make a judgment as to if or not my motive was the public interest to help the students of Alaska, or to help my interest because my son is a student loan recipient? Who makes that judgment and gets inside my head? And who is going to draw the statute that says that the Attorney General will not abuse the powers of the criminal enforcement he's entrusted with to punish legislators that Attorney General doesn't like? That's the kind of thing I'm afraid of, not because I have that apprehension about Norman Gorsuch, but we're talking about abuses of power here, and the abuses of power can be just as real. In fact, they can be greater in the executive branch than they can be in the legislative branch, because our checks and balances are that no one person in the legislature can really do anything. It takes accommodations and support by 59 other people. But the Attorney General on his own can decide that on any given day that Representative Phillips or Senator Josephson was motivated and prosecute on that basis. And that, I think, is frightening. And therefore, while we do not repeal the criminal law, we leave that as it is. What we are trying to do is to assure you and the public that we are going in the first instance to address these. And in 99.9% of the cases, there should be no need for criminal sanctions. And the thing that, and I apologize for the vigor of my comment to you, but the thing that frightens me from the standpoint of separation of powers, from the standpoint of bringing people into this government on a part-time basis, is this apparent mindset that every judgment we make from 8 in the morning until 8 at night is going to be viewed by you or someone like you to decide what our motive was. And who are you to decide that? And who are you, that's the kind of problem we deal with. There is no more purity in the Department of Law than there is in the legislature in most years.
And Josephson, I think I would feel more comfortable with them having this power if they were elected. And we're going to take care of that.
Mrs. Locker, I'm glad you said that, because I have been one who opposes the elected Attorney General. But frankly, if we're going to have that kind of a relationship, I would rather have it exercised by an elected Attorney General who is not serving at the pleasure of the governor, who may really be annoyed over how a legislator casts a vote. That, I think, has some merit. You'd be surprised that I said that. But I think it has some merit.
Yes, would you like to rebuttal, sir?
First of all, beyond what I believe to have been the appropriate exercise of discretion in the Department of Law in a number of cases of allegations against legislators and crimes by legislators, the primary thing that prevents us from inquiring into legislative motives in the course of hearings is a provision called referred to as legislative immunity in Article 2, Section 6 of the U.S. Constitution. And what that provision does, and it's certainly an issue in the Dankworth case, what that provision does is it provides legislators with, in my opinion, absolute immunity for anything said or done in a hearing such as this, in an open public forum. That prevents us from inquiring into the legislators' motivations for the things done in a hearing or an open public forum. Now, that should answer your question about the student student loans. With respect to your question about...
Wait a minute. I frankly don't think that's satisfactory, because if you think that the careers of people...
Senator, I'm sorry. Let me finish this statement. You were really blessed to let him do it.
Second thing is, you may want to get us out of the process, but there are a lot of people in the state who want to get us in the process. A lot of people in the state look at these bribery statutes, and they'll say, I know that Senator X received $100 with intent to influence his action. Now, if that's a crime, Mr. Attorney General, you have the authority and responsibility to uphold the state laws, and what are you going to do about it? And then we're going to have to go to that person, and we're going to have to say, well, I'm sorry, but the legislature really doesn't want us to prosecute those cases, so in the exercise of our discretion, we're not going to. In 1978, this body passed a number of laws in the revised criminal code, one of which was bribery. Bribery did not set any limit on the amount of benefit, because no matter what the benefit is, no matter what the amount is, if it's intended to influence your decision and you're accepting it under those circumstances where you know your decision is to be influenced, that this legislature has made that a crime. Now, one final thing about the elected attorney general, and that's way beyond the scope of this inquiry. But if it is,
and I'll give you 30 seconds to formulate your thought.
Okay. My thought is, if I was an elected AG, and I wanted to be governor, and I wanted to show how tough I was, one of the best targets would be to go after a legislator who gets a lot of press, a lot of publicity.
Okay, with that, Senator Josephson, yes, you sure you may have as much time as you want now that you're in order.
Thank you.
No, but
on the question of legislative immunity, I don't take much comfort in that, because if you think... That it's a wash when you are charged with a crime and you successfully defend the accusation on the basis that I have legislative immunity, I think you're mistaken. There are two counts in the Dankworth case, and let me make it clear that I'm not addressing your judgment or your department's judgment in those cases of Senator Homan and Senator Dankworth. I know nothing about them except what most citizens know, and I wouldn't want to be construed as commenting on the wisdom or propriety or impropriety of those prosecutions or the defense. But it is clearly not a satisfactory answer to an elected official to say, don't worry about abuses that emanate from the Department of Law, because you can invoke legislative immunity as a defense and get off on what the public would perceive as a technicality. The second thing is that when I said I want to get you out of this process, don't misconstrue what I said to mean that I don't want felons in the legislature prosecuted, because I do. I think I was probably the first Alaska legislature ever to introduce conflicts of interest legislation since statehood. I do very devoutly want that. I don't want to serve with felons. But I also don't want to have the club of prosecutions hanging over legislators on a subjective basis by a Department of Law that feels that it is the first line of defense for the purity of the legislative process. I don't want that. The legislature should be the first line of defense for the purity of the legislative process. I'm open, as one individual, I'm only one, to conforming this to, if you're concerned about implying that we will permit bribery up to $100, and by the way, nobody's vote's going to be changed for a $100 gift, but if that's your concern, or you have other concerns, I hope I've demonstrated that I'm open to that. If you have language, as Representative Phillips said, that you want to add that makes it clear that we mean what we say when we're not superseding the criminal law, please provide it, and I, for one, will vote to include it. But I simply say that I don't. If the public was educated to the problems of the separation of powers, the Nixon era was not an abuse of power by the legislative branch, it was an abuse of power by the executive branch. If the public was educated to that, they would be darn concerned about a mindset that says that it's the Department of Law's responsibility to keep the legislature wholesome. It isn't, in the first instance. That's all.
Bill, do you have any comments?
No.
Dean?
Yes, one. was specific action that they were attempting to influence you on. Whereas under this, it could be a general mindset. And I think that's a significant difference.
Well, let me just point out,
Senator Kemp,
Madam Chairman, that the way I read there, and I'm perfectly prepared to expand any state loan coverage or any contractual provisions to certain members of an immediate family or household. But under the Attorney General definition, their recommended definition, which again, let me read, says spouse, parent, child, grandparent, grandchild, aunt, uncle, sibling, or permanent member of the household, or two, being a counsel, advisor, or consultant to a member or representative of, or having a financial interest in any association, partnership, business, corporation, or other entity. Now that's the definition of a close economic association. That would virtually put every single Alaska Native that's enrolled in Alaska Native Corporation, either profit or non-profit, on the block and available for prosecution under criminal conflict of interest degree to the Attorney General. It would put every Alaska Native, all 80,000 of them enrolled, on the block with their head right out there in the chopping block, just waiting for somebody to chop it off. There's 80,000 Alaska Natives out there, and that's exactly, and each one of them are in those Native corporations, and each of those Native corporations contracts or has state loan provisions with the state of Alaska. And if you get an Attorney General up there that is after somebody, or that wants somebody, then every one of those people that make a vote on a state loan program is available under your definition to be prosecuted by the Attorney General under the procedure, as I read.
Well, I guess, I obviously don't read it that way. The provision requires some actual use of office, and that, I mean, it just cannot be read to include voting on some matter. But I just think, again, I didn't think we were prepared to deal with that. I guess my point is, the language that I, the only language that I can think of right now is to delete the last three lines from page 5.
Starting with line 27.
27, 28, 29.
Bill, will you look at this place?
I mean, that.
He's talking about page 5, lines 27, 28, 29, and number 1 on the top of page 6, I'm assuming.
If the intent of this is, as it was in the confidential information section, to only get this commission involved, some of the more serious cases, then it could be left alone. But again, it's going to confuse people, and I just want the issue resolved.
All right, if I may begin first. On page 5, line 24, just to make it official part of the record, we had an amendment proposed by Senator Josephson saying that after the word gift, on line, between line 24 and 25, I guess it's 24, put the word in any amount. Applies may not solicit a gift in any amount or accept or receive directly or indirectly. Is there any objections from the committee to add those words so that no solicitation at all is allowed, period?
No.
Sorry. Yes, ma'am.
I would object only for an opportunity to clarify that it was never this committee's intent to imply that it was okay to solicit a crying nickel.
That's right.
And we do not need the Attorney General to tell us that it is wrong to solicit. We are correcting language because the Assistant Attorney General seems to feel that there's a possibility that someone might look at this legislation and think that it does, and we did intend to solicit.
All right, so hearing no objections to the term in any amount after the word gift, all right, it will be so put in the language. All right. Now, Mr. Berrier, your opinion, please, of eliminating the last three sentences, or the last three lines on page 5, lines 27, 28, and 29. Yes, please.
Can you take it out? Again, remember, we're dealing with something that essentially will be dealt with by an ethics commission. And as far as the concept that you're going to confuse people, this bill covers and is addressed to a fairly sophisticated audience. You don't have to write them in effect a manual. This language, when you're dealing here, the disadvantage of this kind of language in a criminal statute is you're going in and proving things beyond a reasonable doubt, and these kind of circumstances would be, if you were
Josephson?
I would object to the deletion. After all, if my fiance, if I had one, wanted to give me a $200 watch for Christmas, I couldn't accept it under the deletion. If I performed services, I don't mean legislative services, professional services or business services for someone who wanted to leave me a bequest in a will, I couldn't accept it under that deletion. There's a rule of reason here. I just don't see why we want to make it so hard for people reasonably to serve in the government when our effort ought to be the other way. That's why that language is in there, to allow those kinds of normal relationships to go forward.
Dean?
I have no other comments. As long as this committee addresses that question head on and recognizes that it may cause some confusion, that's fine. That's all I want to get across.
Okay, are there any other comments or questions for Mr. Guanelli?
I guess I have just one more thing in general about the enforcement mechanism. It's something that I guess isn't in here.
You were going to prepare language that it very clearly states this is in no way, shape, or form supersedes criminal.
Yes. This bill, as I understand.
Excuse me, what page are you on?
It's something that I think ought to be here, but is not. This bill, as I understand it, supersedes the common law.
And yes.
The question is, what enforcement remedies are available to the Attorney General or whoever to enforce civil remedies? For example, if a contract is to be voided, if restitution to the state is to be made, if those kinds of civil remedies are appropriate, is it up to the Attorney General, or are the Attorney General's civil remedies completely superseded by this legislation? If the legislature is going to take on that responsibility to order restitution, that sort of thing, I think that those kinds of things ought to be said.
Mr. Barrier, do you have a comment on that?
I'm not totally sure that I understand what he's getting at. If the contract is illegal under state law,
what happens?
This is not legitimized conduct to be illegal under state law. The worry that the Attorney General may not go in under the common law and, let's say, void a contract that doesn't violate any of the provisions either of this statute or of the or other statutory law.
The Assistant Attorney General, from what I've said, is saying something's missing from here.
Yeah, what he's saying is missing is, as nearly as I can tell, the power of the Attorney General to proceed not under common law,
but civil law.
And to proceed, not under statutory law, nor under criminal law, to, let's say, set aside a contract. And, of course, if it violates this statute, then obviously you have the mechanism to set aside the contract as representative of the state. But as something that violates the nebulous floating common law, that doesn't exist, and I think it probably is not awfully significant because I don't know of any cases that that's ever been required.
Senator Josephson?
Let me see if I understand this. First of all, insofar as the page 2 of the Attorney General's letter says that the range of recommendations the Commission can make should include divesting, establishing blind trust, repaying profits, censure, removal. I think that's a good suggestion. I think we even alluded to that in our discussion last week. I have no problem with saying that the Commission can recommend the legislature invoke those sanctions. As to the ability of the Attorney General to seek remedies in the court of law at any time, or whether he must wait for a decision by the commission. Yes, I think he should wait for a decision by the commission. I think he's trying to set, my view is, an orderly scheme and not have a legislator dealing in two forms at the same time.
Just a second.
So that would be my position on that. Now, are you saying that you want that the Attorney General should have powers to seek remedies, civil remedies, under statutes or under do they exist under statutes now, those civil remedies? Can he void, can he go into court to void a contract that violates the law?
That's a good question. Certainly under the common law, you can, but this supersedes the common law. The thing that sort of triggered my mind is on page 13, lines 5 and 6, there is specific authority for the Attorney General to exercise whatever remedies may be available to the state, but only as to former members of the legislature who were found to have violated employees. Former members and employees. So, and the commission apparently is not, or the legislature itself is not going to exercise any authority over former legislators, so they're giving that to the Attorney General. Now the question is with respect to current legislators, current legislative employees, is the legislature going to exercise all the remedies that are set out in this letter, or is it going to leave it up to the Attorney General to take that task? And it, just a policy decision that needs to be made.
Mr. Berry, you have a comment.
Yes, Chairman. 2 points. First, of course, the section you refer to also includes employees in the legislature. But secondly, what they're talking about is when you're dealing with the legislature, setting out a laundry list of things that may be recommended to the legislature as appropriate penalties. The legislature has a wide, wide range of sanctions available as against its own members. I think this would actually, as you get into the laundry list, you know, the courts keep looking, well, you can do this, this, and this, and this, and if you could do that, it would be set out. I think setting out a laundry list would actually decrease the threat of the sanctions that are currently available. Loss of seniority, for example, not that seniority matters, but it can't be in as frequently ordered in Congress. Removal from committees are ordered. There's a whole list of possible sanctions. The reason that specifically the including imposition of civil penalties in an amount not to exceed $25,000 was included was that this was felt to be a sanction that is quite unusual and that should be set out specifically to make sure, A, that it's there, and B, that the commission is aware of the possibility of civil penalties. But the laundry list, I think, would be hard.
Senator Josephson?
As a matter of just its taste, I think, I would prefer to see the laundry list because, for the same reason you just mentioned, it would suggest to the public and to the commission what the range of sanctions might be. And one of our concerns as we went through this was that the legislature could say Representative so-and-so has a conflict and should pay a $10 fine, and in a sense have it both ways, have it that they were coming down on the side of righteousness and in another sense whitewashing that individual's problem. So I would like the statute to show the complete range so that at least the public knows what the legislature might have done or what the commission might have recommended. The most dangerous thing in this is not exoneration of a wrongdoer from that point of view. The most dangerous thing is that you kind of try to preempt the process by, give them the salad instead of the main course. Appear to chastise when a stronger punishment is really in order.
Senator Kelly, I'm assuming you're making a motion to include the laundry list.
I would conceptually ask Mr. Berryer to draft a laundry list that he would make as extensive as possible to show a complete range of options.
It's going to be tough.
Well, that's tough. You've already mentioned them. You mentioned the seniority thing, which I had not considered. Suspension of an employee might—I don't know—all ways kinds of a reprimand, a censure. I think it would be better.
Senator Kelly, do you have any comments on that? Okay. All right, Mr. Berryer, it is agreed upon. They're hearing no objections. We'd like a laundry list of sanctions included in the bill. Okay, it's gone.
All right. Speaking of laundry, Madam Chairman.
Yes.
I can't fail to observe that even Ivory soap is only 99.44% pure. We're not going to be purer than Ivory Soap. I think we understand that.
Dean, do you have any more comments?
The only comment I suppose I have is on looks like the next